Are you messaging John or?
Yeah, you tell me when you're.
I'm ready. I'm here. I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
Always Record, episode 82. John McGuire.
It's too late to fall in love with Sharon Tate. It's too soon, but the bullet's gonna dance in the brain of Reverend Moon. So I think it's time that you all start to think about getting by without that need to go out and find somebody to love. It's too late. Oh, there's no one left that I even want to imitate. But it's too soon to ask me for the words I want caught on my tune. No contribution to rely on some art institution to validate your chosen art and sanction your boredom and let you play out your part. When they got nothing to give, they pull their legs forward negative. Oh, they're so decadent until daddy's money from home's all spent. So I think it's time, cause it's too easy to rely on worshiping devils and strangers in bed. So they do get the drugs, they do get good head. You should have realized I was worth the wait. But you didn't hesitate when he took you off. You let him seal all faith. So I think it's time that you start to think about getting by without that obsession to go out and rely on needing somebody to love.
Hey, John.
Hey.
Hey, can we, like, make it a thing that every time you come on the show, we insert Jack Nicholson saying, "Here's Johnny"? Like, just like a thing. You know what I mean? Like Johnny Carson, we're like, here, you know?
I'm okay with that.
That could be the name of today's episode. It's introducing John, reintroducing him.
Is that Blanche? Am I looking at Blanche from the Golden Girls?
Yeah, it's Dorothy.
Oh, that's okay. See, I'm no good with. It's been years, and I don't remember who's who in the Golden Girls. But the way that she's looking at me is very knowingly.
She's very provocative.
She's very sex wise. She knows.
It's the most bizarre thing, John, to have a conversation with you while staring at that picture. It is. It really does something. Psychologically interesting.
Yeah, I'm gonna.
Well, I used to use it as an avatar when I played cards online because it was just kind of funny.
Yeah. And, also, what hand does she have?
Right. Exactly. What's she holding? You know, people, whether they really believe you're old or not, it's kind of just triggers something in their mind to kind of put them on tilt a little bit. So
perfect.
That's where it grew out of, and I've just kind of used it as a joke ever since. I think it's cute.
Right. And then
David's. Got the Rosemary image, so I'm looking at Dorothy and Rosemary, both sort of staring at me, kind of freaking me out.
But our cards are on the table here.
If you scramble them, it spells all of them witches.
Which I've tried and tried to find that book, and that's a real book, supposedly. Yet, I think that every copy of that book was fucking bought out by collectors.
What book is that?
All of Them Witches in Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, you know, I've only seen it in bits and pieces, that movie, and I recently watched your video, well, like 20 minutes of it this weekend.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't want to watch the whole thing just because I wanted more context, actually having seen the movie in its entirety, which I haven't yet.
Yeah. I showed
but
it to...
It was cool how it synced up just in that first 20 minutes. Like, yeah, I got it, not even having seen the entire movie.
Totally. I keep showing Joe Alexander these sync films that he's never seen the original of, you know? And he's expressed that he really likes not knowing, you know, because he gets to kind of put the pieces together. It adds an element. A lot of these films, like, you can see what's going on. Like, they show up at the Dakota. You're like, okay, they're checking out an apartment. Okay. And then with the witchcraft shit, it's just, it's very easy to follow. But I do appreciate what you're saying. I try and show Melancholia and the Infinite Sadness to people, and it's like, they really have to see Melancholia first.
You know, can I just make a comment? It just, like, hit me sort of what the perfect sort of analogy for these things are. It's sort of like going to the opera, where, like, you don't necessarily speak Italian, so you have a general idea what the story is, and then it's music and motion.
Yes.
This is like sync film opera, or, you know, something like that.
Totally. I relate to it completely as Greek tragedy, and that the music is the satyr chorus. That's like my whole representation of it for myself. Because I was really impacted by The Birth of Tragedy, and that's like its main premise. That's like a huge focus of that book. And so I love that idea of drowning out the sound of the play with these people dressed as satyrs making music, literally. So, and the music element was tied in directly to the Greek tragedy, but, I mean, this is Nietzsche's opinion, of course, but it's well-backed. So I like that idea of literally not being able to hear, because everyone's familiar with the plays. They know the plays. They've seen the plays. And then they add this element to it, and then people have a sense of interacting with the play through the satyr chorus.
And you pick up on stuff about body language and whatnot that you might be distracted away from if you're focused on the language being used. And sometimes language, again, if it could be inhibiting.
Right.
There's a structure to language where it's, if you're blanking it out, you're not internalizing, or you're not, it's not affecting you in the same way.
Right.
So I do like that part of it too. But I was trying to watch it with my girlfriend. She's like, I want to see the whole thing. And I had to agree. So I'm probably going to wait till I watch the whole thing before I do it again.
Well, it's a great movie.
It's true.
And we were just kind of trying to figure out exactly what motivated you to link those two things together. So we started looking up stuff about Mia Farrow, and we found that, you know, that song, you know, Prudence is about her sister, or her, I think it's her sister, is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, every part of that. I mean, like, you start out with Back in the USSR, that was written in India with, oh God, which Beach Boy was it? It was one of the Beach Boys. And then that makes a connection to Charles Manson, because Charles Manson's hanging out with the Beach Boys. And, like, every element of that song, I mean, the song is inspired by, like, all these different Beach Boy songs. So, like, I Wish They All Could Be California Girls. It was a joke on that, of like that, talking about girls from Moscow, you know, like that they were relating the same way, even though it's not like Russia isn't exactly California.
But also famous for its beautiful women.
Right. And they did it.
So whole, it's a joke, but it's also a joke with truth. So,
right.
Yeah. I guess. Before we go too far ahead of ourselves, bear in mind we're talking about playing the film. Playing the film *Rosemary's Baby* with the album, the Beatles' White Album, over it. Just to put that context there of what we're talking about.
Right, followed by Charles Manson's album, *The Family Sings*. So, when I make these videos, I never want to put what in the title. And even in the the comment below, they give me the space to describe what it is that you're looking at, but I make it a point to state my copyright rights in terms of how I believe this is fair use, why I believe this is fair use for educational purposes. And so I take that space for that. And so people, if they're familiar with the album, they know right away. They're like, oh, okay, I'm watching this movie and I'm listening to this album. But sometimes I think it's difficult for people if they aren't familiar with what they're listening to. They're like, what is this? But I also kind of like that element. Just like jumping into something and being like, okay, you know? But yeah, I it's weird. That's one in particular that I want to qualify more, because if people are watching it and then the White Album ends and they're like, huh, what am I listening to now? But it's Charles Manson.
What amount of editing goes into that? Do you cut out any parts of the movie, or is it straight?
No, it's straight. That's why it has some artistic value or merit in my eyes, is the fact that I only am interested in how it will drop if it's exact. With that one in particular, however, I changed one thing. And that's, I changed a couple things, because I start the album not at the beginning. I started on the second chime. And then when you would switch records, because there's two records to the White Album, I move it over literally 1 second closer into Good Night. And it's better that way. It just is. So I did that. but other than that, everything is the same. So, and then Manson's album is exactly as it appears on the record. So, yeah.
Wait, did he spend time at Brian Wilson's house? Did he live in Brian Wilson's house with him, or what relationship did they have? I'm forgetting, if any.
The thing is,
Charles Manson even helped write a Beach Boys, like a song the Beach Boys ended up making. So yeah, it wasn't Brian Wilson, was it? It was one of the other Wilson brothers.
Yeah, I think it actually might be the one who they were with in India.
Oh, I can find that out real quick. I'm sure the internet's even faster, but I have a book on my shelf. But yeah, it was one of the other Wilsons, not Brian Wilson, that him and Manson were pretty close.
Here, I'm going to look up Glass Onion's song facts. And see if I can find, not Glass Onion, that was the other one I was listening to, USSR. I was looking up all these song facts from the White Album last night, and I was finding things to be really interesting. But, I mean, the thing with Back in the USSR is that it's also a joke on Back in the USA, according to them, so I find that kind of ironic, because if you're watching that film, they're saying Back in the USSR and you're in New York City. So it's it's meant to present a type of irony, which I love. I love irony.
Hey, David, your audio keeps kind of like, not exactly cutting out, but getting like quiet and then comes back and then gets really quiet and comes back. John, are you hearing the same thing?
Yeah.
Oh. Well,
Dave, can let's disconnect you and maybe bring you back in, or you want to play with your mic setting or something?
My mic setting is my mic setting. There's nothing to play with. I just turned my volume up a tad. You can do that if you want.
No, yeah, now you're actually cutting out. All right, I'm going to disconnect you and bring you right back. I mean, I appreciate it for what it offers us for free, and at the same time, it's definitely not always.
And at the same time, giving all our information to
sure.
NSA. So I think we both get something out of it. So I don't really think
right, right, exactly. Nothing's free.
Right.
You know, you get the service, and you're giving away a part of your soul and your privacy. Oh, sorry, it's Dennis Wilson. I just found it here. It's Dennis Wilson.
Okay, and this was Mike Love that they wrote the song with. but
right.
But still, I mean, Beach Boys, it holds that connection.
No, I'm saying John asked, was he living at Brian Wilson's house? He was living at Dennis Wilson's house. But yeah, he did write music with them. And I think it was actually through Dennis, if I remember the story, it's through Dennis that Dennis actually was convinced that Manson was a talented songwriter and was trying to get him more involved. And some of the other Beach Boys were not as interested. But of course, Mike Love being like the major songwriter of the group after Brian, then there's definitely a long history there with those groups.
And I've heard one Manson song, and it's eerily pretty, considering how crazy he turned out to be. And so I hear that, and then you juxtapose that with the history of him. Just very strange how someone can have that creative impulse and actually be, you know, create beautiful art at the same time be a monster in other ways.
Oh, Hitler liked to paint.
Yeah, good point. Although he did get, I think, rejected from the Academy. I think that might have, right. Fueled his ego a little bit.
Well, yeah. It's the same thing with Manson. Manson kept having trouble where he was trying to get like record deals. Someone would say they'd work with him, and they wouldn't. Or one of the guys, I'm still not prepared for this conversation, but there is one of the sort of in the main courses of the investigation was there was someone who was staying at the Tate house was someone who had, or someone who like managed the property, I think, was someone who... Through Dennis Wilson had said that they were going to give Manson a recording contract and then decided they didn't want to work with him, and Manson went to the house looking for that guy to say, hey man, like, what the fuck, why did you screw me out of this record deal and blah blah blah, and they thought that was one of the main sort of incentives for Manson picking that house as, like, you know, so he has this other idea of like trying to create a certain amount of chaos, but this is from the perspective of the Helter Skelter, the Bugliosi perspective. This is the main prosecuting attorney, and his sort of lead for the investigation, which the people dispute this. A lot of the alternative researchers find other things that obviously don't get covered in this perspective, but strictly from the more police investigation side, they thought, you know, just like with any crime, you have this personal motive. You know, it's like you can have a serial killer who might be killing quote unquote randomly, but usually the idea is that usually like their first victim or second victim is someone that they have a personal connection to or a personal grudge with. And this was the same kind of idea. They're like, well, was he just lashing out at a kind of celebrity culture, or was there someone that he was hoping to get? And again, if you go from that perspective, then the answer is that he was upset about losing this record deal. And even, it's interesting, he went to the Esalen Institute days before the murder started and played some music for them. And people were like, you know, you're weird, get out of here. And he was furious that they didn't get his music. And that was a really common thing with Manson, is that he was furious people didn't get his music. Or people said it was too dark.
The I'm trying to remember what happened with that. I'd need to talk to Patrick, but I think that the song that they ended up recording that was written by Manson. So when the Beach Boys did that song, I think it may have been recorded on 9/11. And like, this sounds weird, but there is such a repeat of fucking 9/11 in the recording of these things. Like, for instance, the Magical Mystery Tour film was started recording on 9/11/67. Magical Mystery Tour, the album, comes out on December 8th, which is 9 months to 9/11. Charles Manson's album Lie was recorded on 9/11/67, with overdubs that were recorded on August 9th, 1968, 1 year to the day of Sharon Tate's death. So what's weird is if you look at that, it's like, well, he obviously, I mean, I don't know what the chances are of those murders happening on the day that they recorded their overdubs for the album that was his answer to the White Album. And yet, like, so he held that date apparently symbolic. Was he holding 9/11 symbolic? Like, the amount of things that are recorded on 9/11, like, add up in this really fucking weird way.
All right, you know, you just sort of inspired me here. I'm going to have to pull up a... After our show last week, I got a message from Zenor, who writes at a group name for Grape Juice. We've had him on the show. Amazing, amazing writer. Please, everyone, check him out. But he sent a message to me, and I've actually was familiar with this info, but it was a great reminder. It was a great reminder. So I'm getting an echo here.
I know, I hear that. Oh, now I'm echoing. We're all echoing.
Hello? Okay. So, yeah, this was just a great reminder from Zenor. I'm just going to read his message here. He says, another good AR episode. I'm always surprised by one huge connection between 9/11 and Sirius that does not get mentioned. Maybe it's not well known. This concerns the date itself. Please ignore if you know all the following. It's easy to find out that September 11th is the current New Year's Day of the Coptic calendar. That's mildly weird, although it gets much weirder when you look into this. The Coptic calendar directly stems from the ancient Egyptian civil calendar and so claims to be the oldest in history. September 11th now corresponds to the first of the month Tut, the Coptic New Year. Tut is the old Egyptian month of Thoth, named after our favorite god. The month of Thoth and the start of the year traditionally began with the inundation of the Nile and the heliacal rising of Sirius. This is from the Coptic Church website. Quote, historically, ancient Egyptians initially used a civil calendar based on a solar year that consisted of 365 days only, without making any adjustment for the additional quarter of a day each year. However, in the meantime, they knew an astronomical calendar, which is based on an astronomical concept, namely the heliacal rising of a bright star called Sirius, Canis Major, the dog star, at the dawn of the eastern horizon. The day on which the heliacal rising of Sirius occurs marks the first day of the new year. Sirius, or SPDT in ancient Egyptian, that's interesting, they called it Sothis, like maybe it's a different romanization. I've seen it as Sothis also. It says here, Sirius, or SPDT in ancient Egyptian, is characterized by high luminosity and is a member of the constellation Canis Major. It lies about 8.6 light years from Earth. The first day coincides with the arrival of the highest point of the River Nile flood at Memphis, southwest of Cairo, the capital of Egypt, during the early dynastic period of the Old Kingdom. Discrepancies in year length underwent complex calculations considering stellar, solar, and lunar cycles. Ancient Egyptians realized the heliacal rising of the star Sirius, or Sothis, coincides with the New Year's Day of the civil calendar precisely every 1,460 years, a cycle that is known as the Sothic cycle. Our record exists by the 3rd century AD grammarian Censorius that in AD 139, the first day of the Egyptian civil year coincided with the heliacal rising of Sirius, marking the end of a Sothic cycle. This phenomenon was celebrated by issuing coins on the back of which appears the Greek inscription Aion, indicating an end of an era. Egypt was under the Roman rule of Emperor Antoninus Pius. The notion of eternal time was personified and deified. A relief of the deity Aion was found in Oxyrhynchus, present-day El-Banasa in Middle Egypt. This notion found its way into Persian Mithraism and into Gnosticism. There you and then he writes, there you have it, 9/11 has a direct symbolic connection with the rising of Sirius. So that's something I was actually familiar with, and I've done more research into that Sothic cycle and the different Egyptian calendars. But something that sort of catches my attention is, you know, I think it's like Chris Knowles had connected the whole, you know, secret history of rock and roll, this, whether it's through synchronicities or intentionality that you have, or where that overlaps, connection between, say, like Memphis, right? We have Memphis, but we have, where does American rock and roll come out of, you know, and all these sorts of things, that even the new Western cities that are named for these Egyptian places sort of carries that same, you know, mythic resonance. So it's just really interesting connection there. But what I think about is when you talk about why would these dates kind of keep popping up, whether we want to take that from the more esoteric answer of some sort of strange serious connection or just this idea of it's almost like the start of a new year and all these sorts of things. It's a really, really is a fascinating angle to look at this through.
There's something really important worth mentioning here with what I found in the Zohar about the three strongholds, and that if you look at this rabbi from the 18th century saying that it's actually 2 days behind, because I saw that it was the 25th of Elul, which would be that year of 2001, that would have been the 13th of September, and then he said it's actually wrong, and it's 2 days earlier. And then if you look at it, this is the guy who, if you're a European occultist, who you would ascribe to, because you're like, well, this is supposed to be the authority date to when this world shift will happen, where these three structures will collapse, and that'll usher in the new eon, so to speak. But what's really fascinating is that right after that, in the same section of the Zohar, it talks about this star that will rise and literally destroy all the other stars, 70 other stars that are related to the 70 princes that are like the overlords of the planet, that the royalty or the people in power are actually worshiping. They're not supposed to be worshiping God, they're worshiping, or they're bowing before these princes who are actually like interdimensional. It sounds really trippy, but that's actually what you'll come across in Kabbalah. And so I found it really fascinating that they connect the collapse of these structures on September 11th to basically that they're destroyed by this star, and then they're related to stars. And so that there's these stars controlling everything, and that they get, like, basically wiped away, or at least their control gets wiped away because of this one star. And immediately when I read that, I'm like, Sirius, you know?
Now consider that Sirius is a twin star, right? It's a binary star system. You have Sirius A and B. So you have your 70 plus 2. It's your double fantasy. It's John and Yoko double fantasy there. And 70 plus 2, that gives you 72nd Street, on which the Dakota rests, which is where Rosemary's Baby takes place, and John Lennon was killed, and all that sort of stuff. What is 72 is also, in Kabbalah, is a reference to what?
The 72-letter name.
Yes, thank you.
And then if you take six trees of life and arrange them in a circle so that they all meet at Keter, and then you contract them in. It's hard to describe. I showed one representation just recently on Facebook of this phenomenon, but Nassim Haramein, on his long presentation, there's a point at which he uses computer animation to show what you can accomplish with a tree where you fold it into itself, and it's a very complex figure, but he shows how you can actually create 72 Sefirot by doing that. And I found that just fucking riveting, because that's like the whole point, is that they always relate this. This is something that's communicated in the Zohar, but I've never seen it physically represented. And it's almost impossible to physically represent it without a computer.
Sorry, I just want to, let's bounce off that. So for the Egyptian school, 72, so Sirius is connected to Isis and Osiris. Explicitly in their mythology. So 72 also happens to be the number of conspirators that plot to kill Osiris. It's Set is the one who does it, but he has these 72 conspirators that help him in tricking Osiris and killing him. So like, this number is sort of really built into this story. Now, the reason I tried so hard looking into the Egyptian calendar system, and it's really hard. It's the same way like you're saying, like, is it the 25th day of Elul or 23rd day of Elul? It's a similar thing where it's really hard because we have this Sothic cycle, so we can say, like, well, we know that it aligned on this day, but the calendars kept changing. And in that little thing that Zenor copied from the Coptic history website, they make reference to the calendars, and that the Egyptians had a calendar that was sometimes 360 days. They kept changing their system of doing it. They knew it was a little off. And this actually even ties into the mythology. I could be wrong, but I think this number 72 ties in again. I have to look this up, but it's something like, so they have this myth that you have 360 days, right? But then you have these five other days. And the way they explained it is this myth that the universe, so like you have the earth and the sky are in constant copulation day in, day out. But that there was this thing that there were these 5 days of the year. That there was like a spell put on that they couldn't have more children, so there couldn't be any new gods. And then Thoth, again, he gambles with the moon. He has this, like, he gambles with the moon, and he wins, like, one divided by 72, like, 1/72nd of the calendar back from the moon. And so he gets these 5 days, and they have these five special days of the Egyptian calendar, and they consider that their main gods were each born this day. Like, you have Ra's born on one day, Osiris on another, Isis on another. I think it's Set and Nephthys are, like, the other two. I had to check that.
Nephthys? But,
it's Set's wife, and I'm probably mispronouncing it. But
this is funny, because, you know, Nephesh is spirit in Hebrew.
Yeah, I'm totally mispronouncing it, but... Okay. It's that's Set's wife. So anyway, it's this. For me, I've tied this 5 day issue, and just to say, so you really get to this thing where you can't say exactly how the Egyptian calendar would translate, because it's, you're always going to have like a plus minus sort of margin of error in trying to figure that out. But for me, what was really interesting is that the we've talked about the number 317, the significance of the number 317. Then you have Osiris is killed on the 17th day of the third month of the Egyptian calendar. Now, modern people take that 317 to translate to like November 19th or something. But of course, again, we have this few plus or minus margin of error. The fact that you have JFK dying on November 22nd, a few days off, you could theoretically have actually JFK dying on the exact Egyptian date of Osiris's death.
Okay. And so you know that the Beatles' second album came out the day and year that JFK was killed in the UK, which is interesting in and of itself for its own reasons. But then it's also really interesting that they came out with the White Album on the fifth anniversary of his death.
Mm.
Just worth pointing out. Another thing worth pointing out here is that as soon as you said double fantasy and relating that to Sirius, which is something I never thought of, you know, I've been playing double fantasy with The Haunting of Julia, which is... It parallels Rosemary's Baby so incredibly. It's Mia Farrow having a baby with David Bowman, Cure Delay. And the release dates of The Haunting of Julia are haunting in themselves, being that it was released on September 11th, 1977 in Spain, and then it went all around the world for through the years. And it had its final release in the USA on September 11th, 1981. So it's September 11th to September 11th. The film is called Full Circle, is an alternate name. It originally was released as Full Circle. Then they changed it to The Haunting of Julia. Julia is the name of Yoko in... it's the equivalent name. That's why there's a song, Julia, on the White Album that... if you watch it with Rosemary's Baby, happens to play during the conception scene, which is interesting for multiple reasons.
And Yoko even has a miscarriage, I believe, while they're living at the Dakota.
So I've heard. I don't know the date of that.
Yeah, I'd have to check. Yeah, I don't know if they were living there at the time. But John, I'm curious. I'm going to kind of get you in here. I know we're just throwing a kind of fast and loose here, but... does the number, like, do those numbers do anything to you? Like, the number 72 or 1 divided by 70, like, does this sort of speak to anything at all for you as being anything significant?
Not immediately. I'll say 7 plus 2 gives us 9. 9 was always just getting, again, segueing into my own particular interests. 9 was always focused on by Tesla as like a magic number, and he associated it with the ether. I couldn't tell you exactly why, but I'm sure it factored into a lot of his musings and ideas about how to construct his technologies in the first place. So just going there, just... Second thing, though, without getting too much in the numbers, because I like I said, I wasn't sure getting too much, I do have a question. Why is Sirius then such an area of focus for the intelligentsia of these elite societies? Why is it worship? Because if it signifies some kind of shift or some kind of overthrow of an old regime, but they're part of the old regime, is it an effort to co-opt and manipulate that type of momentum, that spiritual momentum, and turn it in their direction? Or does it have, what are your ideas about Sirius? I have my own ideas, but I'd like to hear yours first about why it's such a point of interest for them to worship it. Because clearly it's embodied in Masonic artwork, it's embodied in ritual art, and it's there. It's a relevant part of their theology.
David, I want we can go into the idea of why is Sirius significant, but I just want to speak to one thing. You kind of framed that question in the sense of it's in one sense symbolic of the start of something new, but why would it then be connected to the things that are the power systems themselves? And for me, that's something that I have a very specific answer for. To me, it's the very nature of any kind of power system. You know, it's like the end of something is in its beginning. Like the seed is already in there. And I don't mean this in like a vague way. I mean, you know, look at any kind of revolution that there's ever been. If the revolutionaries are successful, they become the oppressors. You know, you look at Star Wars, the first movie, Episode 4, right? Why at the end of Star Wars are the Rebel Alliance? Why are they? Did George Lucas shoot that scene explicitly to copy a Nazi film, The Triumph of Will? It's explicitly copying that. So what is he saying? They're the ones fighting to overthrow an evil empire, and yet they are in themselves the seed of a next evil empire, right? Yeah,
that becomes more overt if you look at George Lucas's book, Star Wars, that he wrote before the film.
I mean, it's to me, this is actually, you know, like, it blows my mind. You look at, like, Old Testament stuff, you have Moses, you know, the great liberator. What is the first fucking thing Moses does? He gets those people out there, and he's like, here's a bunch of laws, and you have to build me this golden altar and all these fancy robes and all this sort of shit and do as I say.
Right.
You know, it's like,
that has to be qualified a little bit. Because
I'm oversimplifying.
No, well, yeah. It's worth mentioning that, you know, he ascends the mountaintop. So he's liberated the people. They've crossed the Red Sea. They're free. Boom. He goes up to the mountain and he gets the law, which if you look at the Gomorrah, they actually say that it wasn't actually the law that he brought down the first time that gets smashed. So he receives it from God, right? So he gets it. It's like they're really trippy in the Gomorrah. They're like the tablets are actually written on sapphire, and they go straight through the thing or whatever. But he crushes them. He smashes them when he sees what the people are doing, because they're still in the old system and they're imitating the royalty of the Egyptians with this calf, right? So they make this calf and they're doing this thing and they're imitating an Egyptian ritual. And he gets pissed and he breaks the fucking thing. And then he goes back and writes it himself. And the way that it's written, even in the Torah, you can see that now it's no longer this pure message. Now it's laws. And so that's his reaction to the people. And so it's
almost like you're not ready for the true word of God.
Right. Well, you're asking for more of the same. And so so instead of giving you exactly the same, I'll give you something to till. The law that he brings down is the Torah. And that's really important to understand, because people look at it like it's just this list of rules, when in fact, Moses wrote the Torah, symbolically speaking, the way that this is taken by rabbis, is that what he's actually bringing down is the very thing that you're reading, which you have to struggle, and by the sweat of your brow, you will transcend. And so it's all very symbolic, but if you look at like the creation myths of the Egyptians and how that relates to Bereshit or Genesis, you can see that there are these correspondences that are unmistakable. He reinstituted the Egyptian format for the Jews. It's like we constructed pyramids in honor of our escaping, to quote Jim Morrison. You know, it's like...
right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, and the whole thing is written out of Gevurah. So, like, he's written the Torah out of anger, like, which is a trip, you know? It's like, he's pissed. And so everything is a type of judgment that people have to work through. And then for generations to come, they're going to have to deal with this. And so, you know, you can take that how you will, but I find that really fascinating. This is the reason why, or one of the reasons why, the commentator who I've been studying was not published until the last, like, 50 years. And, I mean, that's from the late 15th, early 16th century, because it was considered blasphemous. And one of the reasons it was considered blasphemous is exactly what I'm talking about, at least according to my teacher. That's his explanation. So I find that really interesting.
And, John, you mentioned the idea of the Masonic schools. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify and kind of mush Masonry and the Illuminati exactly together, but you know there is definitely a connection there. Either way, you look at, say, like the actual Illuminati, right? I mean, like historical Illuminati, not you know, let's not even take any conspiracy, anything. Historical Illuminati. What is their mindset? What is their stated goal? We want to illuminate ourselves and our fellow man, and to overthrow tyrannies, you know, the kings and the church, and overthrow the tyrannies, the things that restrict thought and freedom, and have a new age of enlightenment. Now, if you think those guys ended up struggling through all this thing and now may be the actual ones in control, well, that's, it's kind of like the cosmic joke. You know, this would be your goal, and you would end up being the next empire. With Masonry, I feel like it's a similar thing. You know, again, we can say for a fact these are very powerful networks. Was it that they were corrupted over time? You know, as they actually gained in power, did they stray from their actual intent, like every other spiritual thing unfortunately does, right? You know, you have this stated goal of what you want to do, and then you quickly sort of, that pure intent decays either through access to power, or, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet type thinking. Whatever the multitude of factors might be, the results seem to be always the same. And I'm hesitant to say that, because just as David just said, if you're not ready for the new way of thinking, are you stuck in the cycle? I want so badly to believe that there's a way to break out of that cycle. And it's why I think one of the most important things about 9/11, right, what was the thing that was repeated so many fucking times by the U.S. government after 9/11? They called it a failure of imagination. They're saying, we couldn't imagine that someone would fly planes into these buildings, which of course was not true, and it's all this sort of stuff. Yes, it's a psyop, blah, 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 blah. Just boil it down. Take all the extraneous information away. Look at that phrase, a failure of imagination. Why are we stuck in building the Tower of Babel only to watch it collapse, only to rebuild it over and over and over again? Is it not some sort of failure of imagination?
That draws me back to Neverending Story, where the nothing is advancing and destroying Fantasia. At the end, the Gmork, I think that's the name of the wolf.
Yes.
Yeah. He explains to Atreyu, the nothing is a tool, or the nothing advances around people's imagination, because without imagination, people are easily controlled.
Yes.
So I agree that it definitely the original intent of the Illuminist theology was liberation, and it had altruistic intent. But like you mentioned, it became co-opted in ways, and the people that were more institutionalized or more prone to institutional pressures and consolidating power in certain domains took it, used it for their own mental or intellectual, spiritual liberation, whatever, and then, like you guys were talking about, keep it away from the rest of the people so they are easily controlled. And what they create, because those controlled people are still very creative, but they don't have any more imagination, so they're creating and funneling all that energy back to the people at the top. So really, it's like almost a game of spiritual vampirism.
Sure.
Yeah, your Torah becomes a Taurus. It just goes right back in on itself, full circle.
So if we're going there with the Neverending Story, you know, the second half of the book, The Neverending Story, explains why it is a Neverending Story, which the movie never really did. And this is very applicable because Atreyu literally has to remove himself Atreyu keeps the story going. What's the boy's name? I can't remember. But the boy who's...
Sebastian
has to remove himself from the story, and the story goes on without him. And in other words, like, this thing is going to play out, but the best that he can do is liberate himself from the cycle. And so that's how it ends. Like, he is extracted, and then the thing goes on without him, which is communicated in the film, but not to the degree and in the way with the twine serpents and all of that stuff at the end of the book, which I highly, highly, highly recommend reading the second half of The Neverending Story.
The second movie sucks. I've never read the book.
Right.
But I'd have to read the book to really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just to say, I also have not read the book, but... Justin Pasica, the guy from Riot Fish, he also has recommended that to me, and he's saying it's not. I don't think the second movie is the second half of the book, but basically the movie that we all know and loved as children is actually only the first half of the book.
Right.
So that's why he keeps saying second half. It's because the movie took the first half of the book and basically adapted that, and the second half of the story never gets told. Justin Pasica had said to me is the concept, which to me is so interesting. We talk about things like Dr. Jeffrey Kripal has this idea that we see these trends in literature that, you know, have led up to these different stages where man becomes, like, you know, supernatural and all these sorts of things. Then we entered this sort of modern stage where it's everything is you are a character in a story. It's kind of this never ending story where all these the let's say the meme or the common trope becomes that we're all characters in a story. And he's telling this sort of postmodernist or post-postmodernist era we're in now, which is what he calls authorization, where now instead of the narrator or the reader or the characters or the writer becoming the author themselves. So it's not just realizing you're in the story, but realizing you're actually the author of the story and you get to write it. And he calls this process authorization. Now, apparently the second half of the Neverending Story book goes into this, where Sebastian wants to fight the nothing. He has to use his imagination, right? And he has to kind of rebuild. But then once he realizes that he has the power to build his own world, now the question comes, and apparently the second half deals with, what do you build? Once you're the author, you know, it's one thing to have the Gnostic realization that you play a role, you're the quantum observer, blah, blah, blah. But the next step is, what do you do with that?
Right, there you go, Moses.
right.
And the question I have is, okay, if Sebastian gets liberated from the cycle, then where does he go? And that's always a question that's fascinated me. And that's where I see Sirius tying in, because in a lot of the artistic, and I'm not as familiar with the text, but I've read historians who are, and they say that there's an emphasis on basically taking a boat to Sirius, or you could consider, like, you know, the ferryman, the boat to the afterlife.
Yeah, you take the rabbit.
Say again?
The rabbit. So that's lepus. So this is something that was pointed out by Kevin Helcott that blew my mind very early on getting into this internet synchronistic area, was that he was drawing a correlation between the rabbit constellation and the Canis constellation, so that Anubis, who is Sirius, who guides the soul through the underworld, is actually riding upon the rabbit symbolically. And so he ties that into, like, the white rabbit, and that you're always late for the date and you never quite arrive, and that's the nature of the movement of the stars, and that we're never quite catching up with, like, it's always ahead of us. Kind of trippy. That ourselves are beyond ourselves, so they're always one step ahead, so to speak. At least that's how I interpreted his understanding.
Right, and Orion, so if you look at the constellations, you have Sirius and Lepus, the dog and the rabbit, and just above them is Orion, and Orion is the hunter. So the dog is supposed to be his dog. So what are they hunting? Well, they're hunting the rabbit, right? The Egyptians saw Orion as Osiris. So you have this idea of, like, yeah, the idea that it's a constant chase, I think is pretty interesting. And David, maybe you could speak to this idea of, and this is a very Eastern idea also, right? Like the idea of getting off the wheel of samsara. You know, is this something to be freed from the cycle? And what does that mean?
Right.
You know,
well, you know, I was staying at a Zendo in Shasta. I stayed there a couple times or a few times. And, you know, the people there, the monks there, they have this idea that, and I don't know, I mean, they're really serious about it, no pun intended. And I don't know how universal this is, but their understanding is that the thing about Buddha is that he doesn't, you know how they say at the time of death, you know, there's this light. And everyone goes into the light. We're like moths, you know, this is just what we do. And he's saying the thing that the Buddha does is he turns away from the light. And it's very much in line with the idea of the hermit who's turning away from the light that he's holding, is that you actually are not ultimately, I mean, both are equal options, but the light implies rebirth.
Have you ever seen Logan's Run?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that, right? All the people, they get on the carousel, which is the spinning wheel that never goes anywhere, and you get on the carousel hoping to be reborn.
Yes.
And they go into the light, and then the guy who breaks free is like, don't go into the light, it's a fucking trap.
Right. And Poltergeist.
Yeah,
you said to stay away from the light. Go into the light, Carolean.
I always wondered how spot on Philip Dick was on this point, because in Ubeck he talks about two different near-death experiences where there's a red light and a white light. And both of them seem to lead to reincarnation, but which one you pick depends on how tumultuous your life will be. And so the question is there like a third way where you can free yourself from it? Or at that moment, you know, why was there all this emphasis on, like, you know, the Book of the Dead and how to navigate the afterlife? And that seems to be like that first portal after the fact in the maze. And it's like, what is your first decision? And if you can't even make that first decision, then maybe you're not ready to go to the next.
Right.
So understanding that point, I think, is important, or at least worth thinking about.
Yeah, I don't know if you've considered that. So Philip K. Dick has had his own set of serious experiences, right, or serious transmissions. There was a theory, I think this was that guy Freeman. I think it was Freeman was the one who said this idea, and I don't remember where he got it, but that's where I heard it at least, was that the colors red, white, and blue that we see throughout the Western Empire network, you know, America, France, Great Britain, blah, 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 like it's all red, white, and blue, that some people have talked about the idea of that being the colors of blood, but that it's also the colors of Sirius.
Yeah, isn't that the two? There's the blue star and the red star?
Well, if you look at Sirius in the sky, it alternates. Like, it is, you know, especially on a clear night, I mean, it is incredible. There was a night I was in Virginia visiting my wife's family, and it was so clear. And, like, we were standing in the road going, what the fuck is that thing in the sky? Like, it looked like we were sure it was, like, some sort of UFO or crazy plane thing. Like, what the hell is that? And it was only after a while that we realized, oh my God, that's serious. It was just so queer. I had never seen it, you know, whatever it was. I mean, it was like a lighthouse in the distance. Like, it was like, beep, beep, you know, like crazy beams of light. And it's, yeah, it twinkles red, white, and blue. Huh. So that Phil K. Dick would see this red, white, you know, Roxanne, right? If anybody would see the red light and the white light, I guess my question is, where's the blue light? And there's this, I don't know if you got familiar with Anthony Peake's work. He's been talking about this thing, they call it the lucid light stimulator. It's this thing that's supposed to, like, stimulate your pineal gland and basically give you an out-of-body experience. It's kind of like DMT in a strobe. Mm-hmm. And it's...
Adam Smith talks about that in Powers of Mind.
It's a blue light. And, like, when I first came across this thing from Anthony Peake and the lucid light device... And it's not his device, but he's talked about it a number of times. I couldn't help but think of Look at All the Happy Creatures, which of course has the main two characters, supporting characters are a dog and a rabbit. I didn't do that on purpose, but all these things to Sirius, it's this thing that it's this blue light that stimulates everyone around the globe's pineal gland at the same time. It gives this global hallucination. Or hallucination or transcendence, however you want to view it. But I these were all ideas that I had, and I painted it in a very dark way. And now here I am a number of years later, and I'm seeing these things as, again, not necessarily good or bad, just, you know, sort of a little bit more objectively looking at them. And there is a very direct through line, at least from my synchronicities and the things I've watched, of Sirius, the dog, the rabbit, and the blue light.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dan.
No, you go ahead, sir.
In Dick's exegesis, he goes on a bit of a rant about what would it take to change the world, because he is concerned with politics, he is concerned with economics, distribution, so on and so forth. So he asks, what would it take to change the system? And he says, basically, if everyone had the experience I had, we wouldn't have this issue. And he doesn't go on to applaud himself for being a great person, because he says quite plainly, I'm still kind of an asshole. But stuff that I used to be concerned with, you know, I let it roll off my back, not as concerned with material stuff, certain things come easier, I'm not as stressed out, so on and so forth. So from that kind of revelatory experience, people realign themselves towards different systems. So the question is, like, how can we wake people up? And, you know, most activists would say, okay, we have to go out and yell and do this and that. And I'm of that kind of Philip Dick conviction. It's like, if we get everyone to trip for a day, you know, it would bring this kind of mass awakening. And then the question is that part of that larger game being played by the elite, where, you know, you could get into the calcification of the pineal gland or the effect of TV on your brain and all this stuff to kind of keep you asleep. And if that stuff wasn't going on, would Sirius or would these kind of stellar objects or this universal kind of clock, like, just snap into place and people would have this realignment? So right. It's borderline fantasy, but it's also a serious question. If we're lining up the pieces, it's like, has that happened before? Is that what people were always preparing for? Was that kind of next stage? And if that next stage is aborted or put on hold by people that control the strings, you know, it's not going to happen, at least for a while.
Right. Well, there's this idea that when an eon comes to an end, that somebody needs to emerge to create the new law that will then have an impact on the rest of that age. And this is a belief system, of course, but you can see if you follow the ages. First you have the Old Testament, then you have the New Testament, and Crowley's whole deal with the Book of the Law was that he was creating the law for the new age. Now, I'm kind of insane in this way, but I look at Jim Morrison's An American Prayer as the, like, if you were to look at the Book of the Law as a serpent that's ascending a pole, I see Jim Morrison's An American Prayer, the book that he self-published and gave to 200 of his closest friends, as the other serpent. and that the text is actually meant to go, the two texts are meant to insert into each other, and they actually act as this caduceus for the next age. Really trippy thought, but...
Can I just... I keep coming back to Happy Creatures. It's not a promotion of the book. I actually kind of don't want people to read it because it's not... it's really, really raw and all this sort of stuff. But it's not polished and it's whatever. It's in a lot of ways, it's an embarrassment for me, but I also know that I tapped into something very strong there, because basically what I was playing with is this idea of, John, when you say the idea of like everyone kind of tripping or having this experience, to me this was what was almost spoken of in the 2012, the theoretical 2012 event, right? The like mass ascension was almost like, if we fell into this galactic alignment, it was like almost like that was possible. And I allowed myself to entertain that thought that, well, almost like a cosmic feng shui, you could have a moment where suddenly everything falls into a sort of clarity. Now, at the same time, I'm of the mindset that, yeah, like, even if everyone had the vision, it doesn't mean that everyone is going... It's not like, oh, we all have the vision and now we just sit around singing Kumbaya, because the reality is most everyone I know who have tripped still haven't figured out a damn thing. They got, like, a great insight into something and got a whole host of new and perhaps more... valid questions than the old paradigms questions, but I don't know if, you know, it's not necessarily an answer. It's a glimpse at something, and then it's again, it's just like with Neverending Story. It's like, well, then what do you do with it? You can have the Gnostic experience. Now what? You know, it's like before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, you know, chop wood, carry water. Or is that going back into the cycle?
Right.
But in Happy Creatures, something I did is. I didn't realize I was doing this until the end. I'm connecting all these things, and this was an idea I had as a kid, that there were these worms that flew through the sky. They were like these like biological missiles. And what I do is at the end, it was only after I finished the book that I realized these were flying serpents, right? This is Quetzalcoatl. This is the flying serpent. This is the caduceus. This is all this sort of stuff. So I actually inserted that I inserted a graphic of the caduceus in this scene of where these worms are all flying and what's happening. Anyway, I did this thing, David, that might interest you. There is a scene where the genetic engineer guy who designed these flying serpents, he views them as his children. They're these like living weapon things that he views as his children because he designed their genetic structure. And he's sitting down reading to them a poem. There's an Edgar Allan Poe poem called Conqueror Worm, The Conqueror Worm. And so I call them in the book. I named them after this Edgar Allan Poe poem. So because I had... named them after that, at some point in the story I decided to have the guy actually read this poem to the flying serpents. And yet I had this idea, instead of just quoting this whole poem in the text of the book, what I did was I took every other stanza from the poem and put it in the book. And where I removed a stanza, what I would do is put in my own narration, but it was a narration that was a... adaptation of that sentence. So if it was something like, you know, in the poem it might say something like, the curtain was drawn and the lights put down or something, and I might say something like, he turned down the lights, whatever it was. Like, I'd have to actually find it to give you a better example of what I'm talking about. But I did what you're talking about, which is every other thing where it's like my text, his text, my text, his text. But I tried to make it that no one would realize that's what was happening. Like, I changed it enough that no one would realize it's what's happening. But that is that is, that's also in there.
Well, I believe that that's the meaning of an American prayer, is because if you pray and you fold your fingers, every other finger, that is the way that Kabbalists relate to, it's a very common practice, where they'll take words like, Ehye, I am that I am, which Moses is told at the burning bush, you know, and they'll, transpose it with, you know, Tetragrammaton, and they'll do it every other letter. But there'll be these long strings. Like, that's one example that's very short, but they'll take these words and they'll interweave them. And it's been known to happen with verses as well. Well, they'll take every other verse. And that was what inspired me to do what I did with the Book of the Law and an American prayer. But I didn't even realize at that point that that's, like, how deeply symbolic that actually was in terms of that symbolism of the folded hands.
Here for me, it was just like a thing, just an idea I had for this story. And again, it's not about the story. It's more about, like, I feel like by doing this, we're having similar realizations or tapping into like a concept, not realizing how, I don't know, important that concept is or how the history of doing such a thing.
Yeah. So I look at it like, so what I'm doing with films and albums, I'm relating to it in the exact same way as literally two hands that are coming together. And like if you look at the back of the Doors 13 album where he's got his hands folded above Aleister Crowley, albeit his fingers aren't interweaved, but it's the same principle that he's in prayer above Crowley. And then that's, you know, right there, their final albums with the exception of L.A. Woman. It's the only compilation album approved by Morrison before he died. It's the only compilation album they ever came out with while he was alive. And so, like, I find that really interesting, that it's like he wanted this out there for whatever reason, and that reason is most likely symbolic. And 13, obviously, death, and then he dies. It's kind of all too perfect, you know. So, but then I just wanted to mention here, you know, you were talking about the moon earlier. I'm losing the context, but I was just, you know, something we've made the point on many times on this show is that if you look at the moon card, especially in Crowley's deck, I mean, you can see it in the Rider too, where you have this dog and this wolf, but that the guardians of the two towers, or the individuals standing in front of the two towers, are the dog god. And so you have this Sirius connection, and then obviously Sirius the dog at the two towers and that whole ritual and ceremony or whatever you want to call it, you know, on top of it. I just find that so fascinating. But what I really find even more fascinating is that when you look at the relationship between the sun and the moon card, the way that they translate in terms of, like, you have these different pictographs, right? But why the back of the head for the moon and why the front of the head for the sun? And for me, looking at the commentary that I look at with my teacher and the emphasis that's laid on the medial brain and how that relates to Keter, and that, you know, Keter is the monad at the top of the tree, and it's not the source. The source is Ein Sof. Yet this idea of the relationship between the sun and the moon, and then relating that to the pineal and the pituitary as the transcendent point of the brain, and then there's a light beyond that. And so you could look at the light of Keter as like the light of rebirth, whereas the light of Sirius is transcending birth, or something along those lines. I'm open to looking at it in different ways. But I find that idea so fascinating, that there's this crown on top of the thing, and that the crown is actually recycles you, because Keter and Malkuth are one. And if you give in to one, you're giving in to the other, unknowingly or knowingly. You know, that you're creating rebirth, and it's part of a cycle. And so I've had this whole...
Do you take that... I'm sorry, I want to ask a question there. Do you take it as... So when John mentioned the idea of, like, you know, sort of overthrowing... We had this idea of overthrowing the tyrant makes you the tyrant. Well, it's like if you view the tyrant as the crown,
right,
and you view yourself as the bottom of the pyramid or the bottom of the tree, you're the low man on the totem pole, he's the tall man. By overthrowing him, since he is you, you know, is it like that, where you're sort of taking out yourself, thus the idea of the suicide king? Oh, but the other way of doing that is of looking at it, and I don't know if we want to make a distinction here, are you saying that, or are you saying more like nature abhors a vacuum, where you have, like, you take out the one, well, then you have to take its place.
Right, well, the queen is in chains, and she's has a replicant in her place, and we are one with the queen. We're in exile. As long as the Shekinah is in exile, the people are in exile. Once you wanted revolution, now you're the institution.
How's it feel to be the man? It's no fun to be the man.
Stay.